Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude, thanks for listening. My guest this week is an icon of South African football. Clive Barker coached the South African football team, the Bafana Bafana, to victory in the African Cup of Nations on home soil back in 1996. Just want to say thanks to Clive's son John for setting up the chat. It took place at John's house in Melville. Clive made his professional debut as a player at the age of 16 for Durban City, but his professional playing career was curtailed by two serious knee injuries, and that pushed him then into coaching. He still wanted to stay in touch with the game, and that was the option. But as you'll hear, it was very much a kind of make-it-up-as-you-go-along profession back in those days. He's recently published his memoirs. The book is called Coach, The Life and Soccer Times of Clive Barker. It's been written in conjunction with Michael Marnowick. The book is a journey through modern South African football and contains some wonderful anecdotes and reflections from Clive and also many of the famous players he worked with, including Calvin Peterson, Mark Fish and Dr. Kumalo, to name but a few. Clive was at the center stage of a golden age for South African football for about two decades, and it's just fascinating to hear some of his stories. Unfortunately, our conversation was slightly curtailed because Clive had to rush off to another interview on the morning we met, but we did get a chance to discuss the famous 1996 final, some of the characters he coached, his relationship to Nelson Mandela, the qualities he looked for in a captain, and what might be done to make the Bafana Bafana rightful contenders in football again. Hope you enjoy now my chat with Clive Barker. So, Clive Barker, thank you very much for your time this morning on a gloomy Johannesburg Saturday morning. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Nick, for having me, and it is cold.
Yeah, especially us guys from Durban, we battle, right. I tell you. It gets below 20 degrees, we put our jumpers on. Clive, I was at the book launch the other evening for your book, Coach. It's called The Life and Soccer Times of Clive Barker. That's written in conjunction or in cooperation, I don't know, how would you put it, with Michael Marnowick. And it was, as I was saying earlier, it was really beautiful. I thought that, you know, you had so many of your ex-players from that very famous 1996 Africa Cup of Nations team there with you on the evening, Lucas Radebe and Mark Williams. He seems a bit of a character.
He is.
Sean Bartlett, Mark Fish. I mean, they were all sort of legends in their own time, weren't they?
They were fabulous personalities to work with. It was nice to have a balance. Mark Fish was the guy who caused all the nice problems.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Mark Williams was the singer of the band.
Yeah, you said he couldn't sing for jam.
He couldn't hit a note. He was absolutely hopeless, but he was marvellous all around. And
how do you sort of build that team? How long had you had them before you went into that competition?
About 15 months.
That was through the qualifying then?
Yeah, went to start with, and then they realized that they needed somebody to host it. And I went from, well, we went from being top of our league into the hosts, which is a huge advantage.
What were the circumstances under that? Was there
Kenya had a problem, either politically or something like that.
Okay, and they were meant to host it.
And we were fortunate to take over and fill that gap.
Yeah. That was quite a day. I remember watching on TV you flying your aeroplane up and down the touchline. there was something that came out of that chat, that whole decision to play Sean Bartlett over Mark Williams. How do you make a decision like that? What are you anticipating from the game that allows you to hold somebody back or makes you decide to do that?
Mark had a marvelous start to the competition. In fact, he was a factor right throughout. But I looked at the pace that they had at the back, and I thought it might cause us a problem to break them down. And of course, Sean Bartlett was much quicker than Mark. Mark would say different, of course, but he genuinely was. He was, and you know, I think the change was because it was something that was likely to suit us. We needed it to be a bit quicker, and of course, Sean he filled that block, and of course Mark had to have the problems of being left out in the cup final. And I've amazing when I announced the team and I looked at him, he didn't change at all. And I thought to myself, God, he's taken it well. And then, of course, on the way to the ground, he gets up and he leads all the singing. And then culminates it by getting on and scoring the two goals to make us the champions.
What a day he had.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah. Let's go back a little bit. You're from Durban. Whereabouts in Durban were you?
I was born in Belair, Sea View.
Okay, right.
At home.
Yeah.
My mum was a dancer of note. My dad was a boxer of note. And, okay, of course, we were always involved in some sport. And
was
football.
He a professional boxer, your dad?
No, he was an amateur.
But he
and
boxed.
His claim to fame was he fought Jimmy Tawil, one of the Tawil family.
One of the Tawils.
Yeah.
Right. That was always a kind of distant part of Durban for me when I grew up, you know, growing up on the Berea, I suppose in a sort of middle-class academic environment. That part of Durban was always seen as a little bit...
Seedy.
Well, it was kind of on the other side of the of the tracks, as it were. Do you know what
was.
I mean?
No, but and that was the truth.
Yeah. It was a kind of white working-class environment. But interestingly enough, given that it was that you would expect it to be quite a conservative place then at the same time, it actually became, I suppose, one of those first unofficially integrated areas, that whole sort of Finland's Yellowwood Park kind of neighborhood was grey quite early, wasn't it? Is that your experience?
No, it was the experience. And, of course, the Codmore River was the big river that everybody went to swim and catch fish in and knew it backwards. And just fabulous area to bring or to be brought up. And I think Yellowwood Park became a bit of an option of being a bit classy.
In that area?
In that area.
Oh, it saw itself as a little bit more fancier than, say, Finland's.
Whether it was, of course, I'm not quite sure.
But, I mean, there was like a lot of railway railway housing tracks and things like that. And the actual lines. I mean, there was all those shunting yards. And
well, wonderful. It gave me a security of being safe. I don't know why, but I loved the train trips to Joburg when we went. They were marvellous.
I used to take the train to Joburg?
Yeah.
Did you used to go into the... I remember my dad used to take us to the harbour and look at the steam engines and climb into the cab and load the coal into the fire and all of that sort of stuff, yeah. So you were a footballer. You played football from a very young age and you became a professional at a very young age, which was... And you must have been the youngest professional...
I was, I think, at one stage.
...in the country. And, I mean, I didn't even realise that there was even money in football, but there was a little bit of money for players at that time.
You
this
better.
Is now in the sort of, what was it, mid-60s?
Well, early 60s.
Yeah. Early 60s.
Yeah, they had Durban City and Durban United, and funny enough, blacks weren't allowed into the grounds to come even watch the game.
Yeah.
Crazy setup.
It was ridiculous.
And of course...
But then the teams were integrating even at that early stage?
You weren't allowed to.
Okay, so when did you sort of first experience that sort of multiracial play on the field?
Because later in the 60s.
It was soon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the context of apartheid, how did that...
Well, the legendary Sugar Nkulu and I bonded very, very closely, and he took me into the townships, and thank goodness, because I wouldn't have known what was happening in South Africa. Everything seemed to be normal.
Just a little bubble, yeah.
Yeah, the Indians were allowed to come in and support. They formed their own league and called the Federation.
Yes, right. There were all
Eisenhower and all the big guys were standing up to the government. And I've always said that football broke down more barriers than any politicians, because they went in and mixed it and went into hotels where they weren't supposed to be accepted. And I suppose the hoteliers must have got some credit because they wanted the business. But we arrived into the hotel and we had a couple of coloured players. And all of a sudden the receptionist would come out and say, sorry, no whites allowed you. And of course it happened the other way around when I went to Kimberley. Late at night, I booked in Amazulu. And then I asked for my keys, and they said to me, sorry, no whites allowed. Yeah. So, you know,
it was such a ridiculous, crazy situation. But, I mean, that process of integration on the field, as you say, seems to have outstripped the laws of the land.
Mm.
And just, I mean, was there any reaction from the state? Did you sense any police
presence?
Yeah, involvement, surveillance, that kind of stuff, or trying to sort of stop that?
Well, I loved it when we were allowed to have the voters when the National Party controlled this country. Of course, it was a way of venting a few feelings, and I would stand there with my rosette on the day, and I remember getting to one point at Ballet School and shouting, "Free Mandela, Free Mandela," and of course they marched me off and then said to me, "Don't ruin a perfect day," which I was.
Because they just didn't want to know.
No, I just didn't want to know. No. And of course it was happening, but
yeah.
But there, obviously there was always some barrier.
Yeah.
Tough.
Nelson Mandela, you did mention him, I suppose, and I suppose it's appropriate we just maybe touch on him briefly. It's the centenary now of his birth this year. I got the impression that you sort of got to know him quite well.
I did. In fact, I met him on many occasions. And of course, when he turned around and said he was going to come watch us play against Zambia on his day of being inaugurated as the president of this country, I said to myself, no, it can never happen. And it happened. I mean, it had the biggest security I've ever seen in my life. The feeling, the vibes. Yeah. And he was all part and parcel of it. And he took an active role. And as I say, say in the book, Susie, my little niece, she one day answered the phone. And of course she said to me, "Oh, there's a guy by the name of Nelson wants to talk to you." And of course, he was. He came to Sunnyside Hotel where we stayed, and he would bring his kids along, his grandchildren, and they would all play and intermingle with the players, play a bit of pool, throw the darts, and just have generally a good time.
What were your impressions of him as a person? I mean, what did you take from those interactions yourself?
Yeah, I just thought I said to Neil, first of all, when we went upstairs.
Neil Tovey.
I had a bit of a knee problem, and I said, "I'm not going to be able to help. You must hold his hand or his arm and help him out into the place where we were, had our fun roll." And Neil did that for me. But he would come and he would listen to my team talk or talk about the game the following day, what I expected, and he would sit in there and listen. So it was huge pressure. I mean, the pressure on black South Africa became big when we won the World Cup, and I sat right behind it when Joel Stransky got it.
And oh, you were at the stadium?
Yeah. And hit it, I said to myself, "Oh, that's extra pressure." You know, not that we didn't want them to win. We were right behind them, and they were very instrumental in what we did. After we went down to Cape Town, saw Mornay, saw Noakes, the physio trainer, and of course they helped us and told us exactly how they did it. And so we interacted very, very closely with Nelson Mandela and with them.
And I suppose for the players as well, it just must have been like an injection of adrenaline.
The one time he decided to say he wanted to see us at about 5 o'clock in the morning. Of course, everybody got out of bed quickly because you couldn't turn him down.
He was there.
He was there.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Let's go back a little bit. You played.
Is this yours? Yeah.
Carry on. That's yours.
Okay.
You played, and then was it your cruciate that you blew?
I did the knee. I did it up here against Rangers at Rangers Football Club.
How old were you then?
I would have been 16.
Playing for Durban City.
Mm.
There was a big, Durban was quite a centre for football back then, wasn't it? United.
It dominated football. In fact, until the late 80s, KwaZulu-Natal dominated football.
The AmaZulu Bushbucks.
Yes.
We'll get into that Bushbucks team as
Durban
well.
Durban City.
Yeah. But that must have been like heartbreaking. I mean, how did you sort of process that moment at the time, and how did you sort of cope with that?
Well, I thought that the operation, the cartilage operation, would do it. But unfortunately, when I went back, the first one, when I went to head across, I jumped. When I came down, I did my knee and popped it again. And of course, they get worse and worse, and the ligaments get torn more and more.
Yeah. And again, I suppose it's also, as we'll go into a little bit later, one of the progressions of the game has been the surgery or the medical attention that players have now compared to back then. So you were sort of kind of a victim of
circumstances
at that point. But then to decide to go into coaching, I mean, you obviously had such a love for the game, you wanted to remain in touch somehow. Is that kind of what was driving you then?
Well, you know, I had that company that went into liquidation, and I had to have two jobs.
Is this when you were driving taxis?
Yeah, I was driving taxis. One in the morning, one in the evening. And we took it from there.
But, I mean, in terms of becoming a coach, what were the sort of structures and processes in place then? I mean, here, you know, you read about players doing, especially in Europe, you know, doing their FIFA badges and their this badge and their that badge. I mean, were you just like, I think I know a bit about the game that I can impart knowledge.
Yeah.
And off you go.
That's exactly how it happened. And I thought I would just use my football skills that I had, to show how to head a ball, how to cross the ball, how to catch it in your chest. And I got a little team and I watched my parents and the ones who drove the nice motor cars, of course, I made sure that they bought all the footballs and equipment that we needed. You know, you're okay.
I nearly choked. Yeah. What team was that? The first team?
Well, the first team was St. Patrick's.
Is this a sort of semi-professional?
Yes.
Or?
Oh, no, it was not even semi-professional. It was amateur.
Yeah. And how old are you now then, when you're starting your coaching career?
About 20, 28.
Okay. So
I had about 8 years back in the game where I played it. I still think half pace. I did a second knee. And, of course, with both knees crocked. It was the ideal time to go into coaching.
And so you just jumped in, and did you have immediate success or immediate failure?
Absolute failure, hopeless. I got relegated first time out. Thought to myself, gosh, what can you do to change this? Because I trained 3 times a week, which was a lot, because most amateur teams only train twice a week.
And those were sort of in the evening sessions?
Evening sessions. But the team, the little team, did well. And then I went on to, I needed some money. And of course, Finland's and Bayview. It was Finland's I went to. And in our first year, we got relegated, as I said. Not a good start.
And so, what did you stay with them after that relegation? And then
we got them promoted.
Right.
And went into the amateur setup. But I joined a team called, you might recall them, Juventus.
Juventus, yeah. They were one of the Italians. Big club sides.
They were, yeah.
With Stella.
They were near the Greville Racecourse on the bend there.
Yeah.
I think they had the famous hockey club.
Yes, exactly. I'm trying to think what that ground was called now. It was next to Curry's Fountain, eh? Somewhere in that part of town.
Botanic Gardens.
Near the mosque, yeah.
It was called Botanic Gardens.
Botanic Gardens, that's right. Yeah. I live just around the corner from there, actually, funnily enough. But it sounds like your coaching input is more just on a kind of technical skill level as opposed to a broader tactical kind of approach.
Initially, yeah.
How did that change then over the years?
I think with experience more than anything. And I think that was the way to go. By a bit of time, went into the amateur ranks and had the likes of Stella, who were the big team, and Hillary and those like. And I remember us winning the promotion.
Eskom, I think, was also with them.
Yeah, big team.
Yeah.
And I remember winning promotion, and Neil Finnegan, who was ended up a friend of mine, as we went up to get our cup to say that we got worked our way into the top league in amateur, he stood up and said, up this year and down next. And of course, that was just the motivation we needed.
Yeah, so you cleaned up again.
We ran the second, first time out, and then we won and got promoted. Well, not got promoted, but we won the league.
And you kind of learning as you go still. again, what is that shift then? Because it seems to me that football tactically back then was quite a simple
thing.
4-4-2, big defenders, fast strikers, and off you go. Was that sort of very much your experience? And when did you feel that that kind of approach changed then?
Well, you know, the axis of a good goalkeeper, big centre-half and good, midfield player, and a striker could put the ball in the neck. I mean, that will never change, no matter what formation goes, and it'll always be like that. And, of course, in the amateur league is exactly what we did. Training would have been of a fitness of a degree because, of fact, you only train twice a week, at least, twice a week.
Jeez, that's not a lot, eh?
No, you'd get out there and you'd have a running session, and then you'd have what we call a skillful and tactical conditioning for the weekend.
You spoke at the launch about having a good training session, and how would you define a good training session back in those days, and what was the basis of your understanding of a good training session?
I loved the intensity. If I got that from the players, then I knew it was going to be a good evening. And so I think the word intensity covers a lot of degree of sins.
And what sort of stuff are you doing, though? Are you doing little two-on-ones, three-on-twos, that sort of stuff?
You warm up with the balls initially, then work at either if you got beat 6-0, then obviously you'd work with the defenders. If you won 6-0, you might still work with the defenders.
was that how you like to build your team from the back?
From the back.
Yeah.
I always think that only successful teams do that.
Mm. And I think that still holds today. I mean, if you speak to certainly, I think Sir Alex Ferguson's very much on the record as that. What's his name? The horrible man from who was at Chelsea? Mourinho.
Jose.
And so very much part of Jose Mourinho's...
philosophy, park the bus.
Just put something there and then see how you can move forward. I mean, obviously the game has changed, and we can talk a little bit about that. When it comes to a team, I'm just interested in how you pick players. Do you pick players based on the style of football that you want to play, or do you pick the best players in their position? Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, I think you do pick the players in their best position. It depends on the quality of players that you've got. I think that dictates exactly how far you go. You can bull us yourself that you're a top-class coach, but if you haven't got the players, you're going to go nowhere in the end anyway. So the systems of play, I think, are there for the poorer teams, so they get themselves a little organised to make it a contest. And I think the access that we discussed is the vital reason to build around about it. Forwards, it all changed with the, as you said, the 4-4-2 and the 3-5-1-1-2, whatever comes in.
The midfield diamond was popular a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strange, in the Premier League, the British Premier League now, sort of 2 or 3 years ago, 3-5-2 was kind of just the way you played. And now that seems to be more 4-3-3. And it's, what is driving those kinds of, is it just people looking for an advantage the whole time?
Well, the game has changed, as you know. First of all, there's ball boys. I mean, the old days, you never used to have that. So when the ball went out of play, it now comes in immediately again. And, of course, the pass back from...
To
the goalkeeper, with a throw in and with a pass, when he can't pick it up and he's got to play it. I mean, today you get players sweeping that could be hold positions down as full backs. And, of course, it's a lot closer today. It's a lot tighter. Ideal situation if you can get your team always playing in one half. Because one half, it means if the ball gets given away, you've got players who can win it back straight away. So there are reasons and things that you work at there.
So what would you, looking back over the last 20 years, what would you sort of class as the the significant changes? I mean, obviously the speed now of the ball coming back, but what other changes have you seen? Even if we look at the South African game, what do you think are the most, just in terms of the actual, I suppose, the structures and the ability?
Yeah, it's a lot much more athletic. Today, you definitely get yourself 150% fit, quick, good runners on and off the ball, ability to get from box to box, as they call it, and of course to set up the chances and take them when they come. And I think that the game won't change much more than that at the moment.
It seems that, well, I suppose two things for me spring to mind. One is, as you say, sort of diet and fitness, a sort of focus on that. But also the money.
That has changed.
Has that been good for the game?
I think it's wonderful. People say, if you looked and watched the tennis yesterday and watched that performance, I mean, guys, if somebody said to me to watch it and get the result, it's going to cost you another 100 rand just to watch it. You would have gladly pulled it out. And so I just think that I always say, if you had Nelson Mandela into Donald Trump and to anybody else, the first time that they speak it, they would fill a stadium. There'd be 80,000 people. By the fourth or fifth time, there would be 40,000 people. Then there would be 20. And if you get Real Madrid playing Barcelona, they would fill it every time. And that's the difference in that sport. So people say they shouldn't earn that type of money. It affects the game. It doesn't. They're entitled to it because they fill the stadiums.
Although, I mean, in South Africa, it seems that there are only a very few teams that are capable of filling the stadiums, and they're Orlando Pirates and Kaizer Chiefs, essentially. And wherever they go, they will fill the stadium. But if you go to Cape Town and watch Cape Town City AmaZulu, it'll be a different crowd. So, I mean, from that point of view, it just seems to be a little bit...
Top-heavy?
And I don't know if that is a good thing.
Yeah, right. I'm still in the other camp that I think if they're filling the stadiums, they're filling a need. But I do concur with exactly what you said. Besides Sundowns, you have come into it now.
Well, Sundowns, I mean, that was, I suppose, a brief or a welcome shining light, if we can just touch on the state of local football now. I mean, I've been... Do you follow still the local league?
Not as much as I should. But then I didn't. It's the only coach Yvonne would say that would fall asleep watching the FA Cup final or this and that. So I've never been one fanatic for planning.
Okay.
I've always worked out if you can't get your own team to play to its potential, you're not going to win anyway then. So I worked on the other side of the game by just wanting the players to play like I wanted them, to play off the cuff. That's exactly what good football teams do.
So did you kind of, the style that you developed then was kind of quite loose then? I mean, you were encouraging your players to kind of just think for themselves?
100%.
That sounds like not great. Do you know what I'm saying?
It worked.
Well, it did work. I mean, I suppose, again, as you say, you do have to have the players.
No, you have to.
And how do you identify the players then?
Well, on a consistent basis of watching them play over a period, you see the guys who could accurately put the ball in the back of the net. When I look at Bafana set up in my era, if I think we could have got the likes of Benny McCarthy...
To add to that team.
I think we would have been just about unbeatable.
Yeah.
Because there were times when you played international matches against the top sides in the world that you made them look very ordinary. In fact, a couple of weeks or months before we played France in the World Cup, we really had them on against the screws. And afterwards, when they had the interview, they all congratulated us for our performance, and of course derided them, the French side, for having a very, very poor performance, which they thought. And those type of games against Brazil.
When we were 2-0 up.
Yeah, we went right down to the wire, and I messed it up taking Doctor off, as you know.
Yes, the guys are teasing you about that. What kind of player was he for you, Dr. Kamala, genius. Then?
Absolute genius. Had the ability to put the ball, foot on the ball, to change the pace of the game, to give us the width when we wanted it, and when we were under pressure, give him in shoes of the ball so we could play ourselves out of a bad situation.
Shoes Michu, man. He was also a machine, that, eh?
I was with him when he died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know, I remember holding his hand and knew that it was only a couple of hours.
Yeah.
But he was a super player.
Yes. That was quite a team. I suppose, I mean, as you say, you have to be lucky sometimes to get the players that will allow you to sort of play the game you want. That Bushbucks team, 1985, just talk a little bit about them, because you say that is the best team you've coached.
They could play backwards and win, really. They were a super, super side. And I think it was about 15 or 16 players throughout the whole season.
It's unheard of.
Really made good teams look average. I remember opening the Siskar Stadium, and after 20 minutes I looked at the score, and it was Bushbucks 5, Orlando Pirates 0.
And, Carrots.
Yeah, and I spoke to Mike Mingenna today. He scored 15 goals with his head. He scored 25 goals in the season, which is unheard of in South African football.
Who was crossing for him then?
Bennett Gwandwe from Malawi.
Oh, Bennett Gwandwe.
The left-footed player.
Sure, that's taking me back, hey?
And of course, Kelvin and Michael up front, and Professor in the middle of the park, and Dennis and Daniel Ramaruzzi could run all day. And of course, at the back, the most solid back four seen in the country for years.
Yeah. Professor Ngubane, I think you rated him as one of your...
Yeah, better players.
Yeah.
Super. Could do anything with the ball.
But again, I mean, it's more than just having ball skill, isn't it, for a good player? It's about awareness, it's about speed of thought.
He had everything.
Yeah.
And a desire to want to entertain. And the likes of Joma, entertainment, ace, entertainment. Besides being super players, Ace Manini, really top-class players.
What do you think is... Because I was trying to just... move us back now to this state of football today. I mean, I kind of fell out of love with football a couple of years ago, just especially watching the British Premier League. I just found it, I don't know, just boring and silly. But I have been to, I love football. I used to play when I was a student. We used to, just that smell of the dew on the grass in the evenings and just, you know, just, or in the rain. Great fun. But I've been to a couple of the Soweto derbies, and I've just found like the skill level quite low.
Mm.
Just in terms of just putting three passes together.
Giving the ball away far too much.
Is there are players getting the right coaching? There seems to be so much money in the game and coaching schools and clinics and all of that, but what do you feel is, I mean, how do you assess the state of, we spoke about, you know, Sundowns being a moment of brightness in the dark now, just winning the African Champions League, but we haven't really had much to shout about it, but the Bafana sort of losing to Madagascar and
ugly.
Things like that. How do you assess the state of professional football in the country at the moment?
Oh, we should be dictating it. I mean, when you look at the quality of the grounds that we have, I mean, I was with Pereira, the great Brazilian coach, and we were saying that South Africa must have 7 of the best stadiums in the world. I mean, you've got such an advantage to build on for this, and I agree. I think the quality of coaches, I worry about it, but then, of course, when you look at stats, and a lot of people pull those things out, they would say, but... If you compare yourself with Pereira, Pereira came here, got 1.7 million rand a month. I got 100,000 rand a month. For my 100,000 rand a month, we had to win the African Cup of Nations. We had to go qualify in France for the World Cup. And we had to win the Four Nations 3 times in a row. For his 1.7 million rand, he won nothing. Hmm. He didn't qualify at all. Now, you say Sheikh Mashaba... is he a better coach than Pereira? His record's better. And so I think local is lacquer in coaching. I do still think there's not a good enough quality coach consistently over the whole spread of all the teams, because you'll find that half of them coaches go about 3 months and get fired.
Yeah.
And so I think that there is a weakness in the quality of coaching. And I think that if I was SAFA, I would look at that straight away. I know that they intertwine in some way between... what am I trying to say? But generally, I just think that if you take stats, stats prove that South Africans are better coaches than foreigners. But it's, I don't think it's like that.
I think the English went through the same thing when Arsene Wenger, and then more and more foreign coaches, and then more and more foreign players came into the game, that it was a, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, you'd have to say it was a good thing to have that mix. But maybe is it just that, is there enough coaching of the coaches? Are our coaches then being exposed properly to sort of modern methods and tactical thinking?
Yeah, the hell. In fact, most of the foreign coaches that come here, they come here with the FA coaching badge or this badge or whatever the story is. So I think they're given every opportunity to get what is required to coach in different countries. The CAF have their set up in Africa. So I think there's a start towards it, but as I said, I don't know about the quality of coaches that will come here. If they got a chance to go to the big powers in Europe, they would choose that. If they were to go to England, they would choose that. And so we would be last of
a little bit down the pecking
down
order.
The pecking order.
What do you think will, what do you think needs to happen to get Bafana back to, what do you think needs to happen to get the Bafana back to where they were, where you had them, where we had a lot more players playing in foreign leagues, which seems to also have dropped off completely now. I mean, the youngster Tao now has just gone to Brighton, I think, but he must be one of very few players now playing overseas. But what do you think needs to happen sort of at an administrative level to get our football back where it belongs?
Yeah, I think the argument that you will put forward is about players playing over consistently overseas, not sitting on the bench, not sitting in the squad, not sitting for the in the second tier instead of being there. And I think what happened when we were successful, everybody, all the scouts came to look at South Africa because we had been readmitted to FIFA, by FIFA again. And of course, that's exactly where we were. And they picked the likes of Radebe and Masingas and Mark Williams and Eric Tinkler. They all played on a regular basis. So when I had to select, I just had to have a look at them and then marry them with the successful players that were playing locally. And of course, it seemed to work well. It seemed, the blend seemed to be good. Where SAFA can come in, I would think that they should restart all over again. I've got a feeling that they're not as organised as they were earlier on, because I think they sat back and said, this is what we want to do with our South African football, instead of speaking to the right people. And I think the right people would have been guys who wanted to say, the quality of football served up, is it good enough? Do we need the development? Development is a lousy word. It's a good word. It sounds nice, but you're only as good as the coaches that you have in that development. If I have 10 kids playing for me, and if the guys who go to see, coach them can't head the ball, can't pass the ball, can't do the right things in football, then you're going to get nowhere. So I think that SAFA has to have a rethink. I like to see the intervention of the quality of the under-20s, the under-20, whatever they go along.
Under-23s, yeah.
Pick the right coaches to coach them. If you do that, then you've got half a chance. But if you don't, then we went from 90-odd when we joined them to 13th in the world and back to 90th again. So So we've done the whole circle.
Mm, roller coaster.
Yeah.
What were for you the biggest differences? I mean, everyone talks about this, the sort of shift from club level in whatever sport, whether it be at cricket, rugby, whatever, hockey, netball, from a club level, playing at a club level to playing at international level. What did your players find the most challenging of making that step up? What was your experience of that process?
Yeah, very, very tough, because, you know, there's club football and there's international football. We've just watching international football with the World Cup. And if you see the commitment there and the way they've helped football so much by having the World Cup and falling like it is at the moment. So I just think generally you can get it right, but you've got to change a lot of things to get it right.
For example?
Maybe a change at SAFA.
Hmm.
They've had every opportunity over many, many years, a lot of money gone into their coffers, and maybe it's time for somebody to say, let's have a look at somebody else having a chance. Maybe, I don't say Denny Jadon, but the likes of that, maybe they should maybe look at home.
Hmm. John, do you need something?
If you can, wrap it up, Nick.
Okay. I'll be 5-10 more minutes. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, 5 if you can, because we've got to move.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay,
we're being hurried along now. You have to dash to your next
call,
your next interview. Just briefly then, okay, captain, how do you choose your captain, and what qualities are you looking for in a captain?
I was lucky in having Neil, because Neil played for me from under 16. So throughout the, when he was growing up, I like to see the responsibility that he accepted. The quality of player that he was. In the morning, he would walk down to breakfast, and if you were there where you're sitting now, he'd put his arm around your neck and say, everything okay at home, and can we help in any way? And he would be doing a good job for me right from the beginning. And
just looking after the players.
Just looking after the players, man management, and encouraging them when they're having a bad period. I just think captain... big role to play these days, and more than in our era.
Hmm. And just briefly then on the World Cup, have you been watching the games? Have you enjoyed?
Loved every minute of it, and hope that France go on to win it.
Yeah, he's quite special, that Kylian Mbappe, isn't he?
Yeah, he's quicker.
Yo.
God.
You love him. Clive, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, Nick,
I appreciate
it. For you and for the questions, I appreciate it. Eh?
And
you should have been a coach yourself.
And enjoy the rest of your stay with the grandkids and all that.
Go back tomorrow and start work in Durban.
All the best.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to have you, Nick. Appreciate it.
Sorry again for the time constraints on that interview. I did want to touch on a couple of other topics, including the rise and success of women's football in South Africa. But, it did take me back, I must say, to my youth. Some of those names that cropped up was quite special. Look out, as I say, for Clive's book. It's called Coach, The Life and Soccer Times of Clive Barker. I'm off to Cape Town next week to interview Professor Mabaketi Pakeng. She's the newly appointed Vice-Chancellor of the University of Cape Town. I'm very excited about that, and we'll publish that discussion in the next couple of weeks. Please subscribe on iTunes, where you can leave a rating or comment. Ratings are important for me to reach a wider audience. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time. I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.